Ever try to get into one of Advertising Week's amazing sessions and suddenly hear that the room is at capacity? Now you can still experience it in real time. Listen to that keynote or panel as a live audio stream in the Advertising Week app, powered by Live365. Advertising Week Radio features sessions, podcast clips, curated music, and more, both during the shows and year-round. Visit aw.live365.com for easy access instructions. Live365, the world's audio.
Welcome to Great Minds, and our guest today comes to us via Canada to New York. We met in London on the stage of Advertising Week Europe, where Andrew, you and I got to spend some time together. Our guest today is Andrew Casale. Andrew is the founder, president, and CEO of Index Exchange. He's accomplished an awful lot at a relatively young age. I'm super impressed with what you built, your own media company way back when, initially, namesake, if you will, and Index Exchange, which is give or take 15 years old by now. It's an incredible story. So, Andrew, really good to have you here on Great Minds.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Okay. So, Andrew, in our little chat before we got on the air, you mentioned you recently had cause to go out and make sure that you had an A-plus suit and tie. Let's start there. Talk about Virginia. Talk about what's coming up. And it's not every day that you talk to a central player in one of the biggest, most important issues and cases on the docket, if you will, in our business in the USA.
Definitely. I have not worn a suit and tie in some time in the ad tech ecosystem. So certainly speaks to the importance of the events to follow. I am a witness for the DOJ in United States v. Google, specifically the ad tech trial, which kicks off this coming week. And so, you know, for us, this has been a fairly long journey where there's been certainly lots of questionnaires and inbounds over the years. I was deposed this time last year, and so the trial has been a long time coming, and I'm certainly going to be excited to be on the other side of it soon.
So this is not just an issue here, but it's a global issue, and let's just throw out some general notions, because I'm a layman about a lot of this stuff. It seems to me that governments have allowed Silicon Valley to run wild for years. And the level of sophistication in our country, I remember vividly one of the testimonies where Mark Zuckerberg and others were brought to Congress, and Senator Chuck Grassley, who's give or take 84, 85 years old, clearly barely knew that the internet was beyond AOL and dial-up. The lack of preparation, the lack of knowledge, and I think that's probably an extreme example. I think the EU, in many respects, has their act together a little bit more than the US does on these matters. But this is a big issue. Have the big players in Silicon Valley been able to run hog wild, and they're finally maybe getting a little bit of a balance in how they're viewed? Let's use the word balance.
Well, what I would say is you're absolutely right in that this is a global issue. And certainly the EU has been very inquisitive as well across numerous companies, certainly largely Valley-based. And it remains to be seen if there will be subsequent actions to follow, cases or otherwise. You know, to the root of your question, I really think this is for the courts to decide. You know, for me at Index, I by no means am fully read up on what it means to be a monopoly to leverage a position to advantage another side of a business. But I don't think it's lost on anyone that if you take, what's certainly at issue in this particular case, specifically the ad server asset that Google has, formerly known as DoubleClick, DFP, now more commonly known as GAM, Google Ad Manager. That is a very, very important asset in the overall ecosystem. It has a huge share of open web display, some 90-ish percent plus or minus of major publishers leverage the ad server. And so I think what the DOJ is investigating here is whether or not that asset was leveraged in a way that is problematic. Beyond that, I think this is for the courts to work out, and it's hard to speculate on whether or not that burden has been hit in this particular case.
Go back to that stat you cited about the number of publishers who flow through, because this speaks to how most of us get our information, get our news. We're going to talk about politics. Particularly important to have not just someone's take on the news, but to have the news these days, which is increasingly difficult. Can we dig in a little bit deeper on that point you made, Andrew?
Yeah, like if you look at the ad server for a publisher on the web, whether it be a New York Times or a Washington Post or Dot Dash Meredith or whomever, USA Today, the ad server at this day is largely viewed as a utility. The decision to select an ad server was probably made 5 years ago, 10 years ago, maybe longer. At this point, it is absolutely wired into every part of the publisher's organization, billing, IT, all other sales workflows. And so it's effectively a very sticky asset. The switching costs to swap ad servers would be very high. And so to some degree, and we've certainly seen this just in practice, publishers don't switch. They're on an ad server, largely GAM today. They're unlikely to switch. The investment is significant. The pain would be significant. And so the market now relies on that platform, that utility, to be fair, because everything goes through it. Every ad you see, certainly on the open web, goes through an ad server. And if we're talking about the open web display, that ad server is generally GAM. And so we need that to be a fair and level playing field so that we have a very competitive market. Again, that's what's, I think, largely at issue, certainly in the case that's about to happen to DOJ.
Fascinating stuff. We could spend an hour talking about just this subject, but we have an awful lot of ground to cover. I do feel a little bit like this is the same moment that Standard Oil encountered years ago. And you've got an awful lot of power and control in just a couple of pairs of hands, really. And listen, give credit where credit is due. Just as Google's acquisition of YouTube was brilliant and relative to today, less than pennies on the dollar of what it's worth. I mean, just a comically low number that I recall it went for in 2007. The purchase of a DoubleClick, in many ways, I mean, also you have to use that word prescient again.
Yeah, incredible foresight, incredibly valuable asset that certainly helped in a variety of ways. And if you look at what's followed that acquisition, Google acquired Invite Media and now has, arguably the largest DSP. The Google Display Network is still today arguably the largest ad network to ever be. I think a lot of these successes are rooted in the acquisition of DoubleClick and just demonstrate, I think, the value of that starting point for sure.
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, I remember when NBCU and Comcast came together. And I said, well, is it a good idea for the company that controls the pipes to also own a pretty significant player, who puts stuff through those pipes? And I still wonder about that, Andrew. I'm just not sure that I ethically looking at business, I'm comfortable with so few players owning so many different spokes on the wheel, you know, and this is not like a bicycle wheel that has a limitless number of spokes or seemingly limitless number. It's a car that has three, four, five spokes. You know, it's not a lot that we're talking about here.
Well, I think the question is, can a company that owns so many assets that are disparate continue to operate them in a way that is truly fair and competitive? And if the answer to that is yes, I don't know if it's necessarily a problem, but if the answer to that is no, that is a problem. And again, I think that's what the case in this particular trial is going to either prove or disprove. You know, for us, as a partner, we're a big partner to Google and a lot of the different Google assets and businesses. But in one line of business, we're a competitor. We compete with AdEq. And so, you know, I wouldn't say that I'm necessarily uncomfortable with a company owning the ad server and also being a competitor if I know that they're operating, you know, the platform where we partner in a neutral way, because then I have a fair shot to compete on value. And so I think that's again what's really at issue here. And I think it's going to be a question of can companies be trusted to possess these very valuable assets with huge share and do so in a way that is fair and neutral. We're going to find out.
Yeah, it's another chapter in a book to be written about things that have gone sideways, you know, more broadly in the last 20 years. We stood by Facebook, and you'll recall the name Cambridge Analytica, when they had a lot of trouble. And many of us have seen, or if you've not seen, the Netflix documentary about Cambridge Analytica, absolutely fascinating. And Jeff Goodby interviewed the producers and the star whistleblower Brittany Howard on our stage years ago. And we have a big, big partnership and a wonderful relationship with what was then Facebook, now Meta. And Carolyn Everson went on stage. We put her on stage with the Wall Street Journal the day after, business day after, one of the most egregious leaks that Facebook had. And it was tough. And I give her enormous credit and the company enormous credit for, you know, taking it on the chin, you know, and moving forward, whatever moving forward means. And this is another one of those moments. And I think all of us have an interest in, you know, fairness. And I think what you said is exactly right, that we all want a chance to compete on a level playing field.
That's it. That's certainly all we seek. Like we don't expect anyone to do us any favors. And certainly in business, the last thing that you can incorporate into your plan is hope. And certainly nobody in Index is hoping that you know the government steps in and makes our lives easier. That's not what this is about at all. And either way the trial goes, I think we just want to arrive at a place where we know that we're operating in a market that's fair. That's it. And then we can be judged based on the value that we provide. And we believe, all things being equal, we are pretty comfortable with the value that we drive in this ecosystem. You know, we're obsessed with efficiency at Index, and we think we're in a time today in the market where publishers need efficiency more than ever. Again, I think that's what this case is going to sort out pretty quick, because we have also heard that this trial is likely to be accelerated, and we may even see a verdict before the election, which would be pretty incredible if it actually happens that fast.
That would be indeed. Okay, last question, then we're going to move on. What color suit did you get?
I did ask our counsel internally what would be appropriate, and
Blue. I'm going with blue is my
they suggested blue, so it's a blue suit.
There you go. There you go. Okay. And good luck trying to tie a tie. I still struggle with that.
I will be asking for some help for that.
I aspire to learn the Windsor knot one day. That's on my list of life goals. Okay. Enough about fashion. And I think I'm talking too much. Let's hear a little bit more of you and a little bit less of me. Take me back, Andrew. You were a founder at a very young age. I think you were 28 or so when you took the reins of Casale Media. let's go back. What put you in this business at such a young age? Some people have used the word prodigy. That's a heavy crown. Certainly no one's ever used that word with me, Lord knows. But I'd love to talk about that, what drove you early and accomplishing quite a bit at a very young age.
Yeah, to me, the role I'm in today has really been a lifelong journey that never really had a full-fledged plan, but I've enjoyed every moment of it. I was the atypical whiz kid with a computer very young. Little Andrew, much younger than 28-year-old Andrew, this was 10, 11, 12-year-old Andrew, found his way onto the internet in the 90s. I built websites. I started on, you might remember the name GeoCities. It was one of the first free hosting platforms back in the day. I was just playing. I made websites, didn't know what I was doing. But one day, one of the websites that I made went from having no traffic to having lots of traffic, and I got very excited. Fell into this awareness that people actually use the internet and they visit websites, and there's a value proposition there. And if you provide them with content or an experience that's useful, more people will come. So as I grew into the ripe age of being Andrew the teenager, started to put a lot more effort into building websites that, I sort of refer as being super humble, basic, media company, websites, but, reality television was my thing when I was a teenager. I started to really focus on operating an actual business, much like a baby publisher, where I started to recognize that the early internet, before search took over and social took over, was really driven by portals. There were humans back then behind every portal who decided on, when you open the homepage of Yahoo, what links are there? My discovery early on was if you're the first to write something, so think, a new episode of Survivor airs, and if you're the first to have the recap and you get it to the right human, you can actually really get a surge of traffic. At the same time, we had an ad tech ecosystem in the late 90s, very early, very young. And that ad tech ecosystem, much like Index today has, had salespeople. And so they reached out and they would say, hey, it looks like this website of yours has a lot of traffic. Would you like to take this tag and put it on it and put ads on your website so that we can pay you? And you have to imagine young Andrew, the teenager, got very excited with that. I then fell into the world of ad tech, advertising, and the economy of media at a really, really young age. But I also found myself in a community of humble publishers who were basically in the same boat. We were making some of the first websites on the internet, attracting audience, early ad tech was at our door, giving us ad tags, cutting us checks, no wires at the time. What I then started to notice was that there was a bit of a shared frustration across the community that I was a part of, the community of publishers, which was early ad tech. Well, we all loved the money. We loved getting checks, did a very lousy job supporting the publisher. We couldn't really control the ads they were running. So there were bad ads all the time, which was affecting our user experience. We had no idea how much these companies were making. They weren't transparent with their margins at all. We knew they were making a lot more than we were. They kind of just treated us as a ticket. And I didn't love that. The community didn't love it. And so the founding of Casale Media was really founded to be a publisher-focused platform that put the publisher first. If you kind of look at where we are today at Index, we've never really veered far from that mission. Index is 100% focused on the publisher, very focused on driving the market to something that we call total market efficiency. We want the economics of media to be strong. We've evolved quite a bit since we started the company, I still feel like I'm on that same mission that I started way back when.
Okay. And let's go back even further. Let's go to elementary school, middle school, high school, early days for tech, certainly. But talk about where the roots of all this passion come from.
Yeah, I'm very fortunate that my my father is I refer to him as a super engineer. He's an electrical engineer, which effectively means he can build anything. He was in computing technologies very early. He was on the internet, I think, in the 70s or 80s. So very, very much brought that home, where computers were always around me growing up. The internet was in the household very early. And that had an influence on me, for sure. I'd say, you know, when I think of me in school, the funniest, tidbit that I'd share is, when I was Andrew the teenager, before I went full time, with the founding of Casale Media, I had, set up my flip phone, my, I don't know, I think I may have had a Motorola Razr or Nokia or something, set up so that my servers would send me text messages if they were down. And so you have to imagine me in class, every now and then my phone would buzz, and every now and then my servers would be like, we are having problems with load. And I would leave. I would leave school and go home and fix them, because at that point I was literally running a business. And I wanted to make sure that I didn't, have a problematic audience that turned their back on our site, nor that I had any issue driving ad spend. But yeah, kind of a funny thing to happen in school for a teenager in high school.
Well, I love the way you described it, that it's really where we are today is a journey, let's call it a roller coaster, that you have been on pretty much since go.
Yeah, I have, my passion is the business that I'm in, because it's quite literally all that I know. It is all that I have been a part of. These days I compare notes with people that have been in this business for 20 years. And it is kind of comical that, when they were early career, I was probably a customer of theirs as a teenager. But yet we were still in this business the whole way together. I was just in it in a very different capacity. But yeah, I love it. That's why I've never left, and I've effectively just kind of continued on that journey. And I have to say, there was no plan on what we would become. Very proud of everything we've achieved. We're just shy of 600 indexers today. We're a global company. But more importantly, even when we founded Casale Media, the market was nothing like it is today. The world's biggest companies today are in advertising. Google's one of the biggest companies in the world. Facebook is, Amazon is. That wasn't the case when we started the company. That was never part of the plan. If I think of the companies that we work with and partner with today, it is unbelievable to see the level and scale with which we operate from where we started. But I'd also say what we do, I believe, matters more than ever. Index is a completely independent partner to the publisher. We are here to stand in their corner. We are here to do everything we can to drive more ad spend to working media. We do not answer to investors. We do not answer to big tech. I want to believe it mattered 20 years ago, but I really believe it matters today more than ever.
Yeah, no, you are so right. All right, we're going to dig into where we are right now. I know, Q4 coming up, things are going, pretty well. I think it's a very positive story. We love good news. I love that movie, The Freshman, with Marlon Brando and Matthew Broderick, where he spoofs his Don Corleone character and is talking about his stockbroker. He says, "I like good news. I like it when they go up," in a very certain deliberate manner. So we all like good news. But let's stay broad and keep painting with this broad brush. Every entrepreneur says the same thing. I say it, Andrew. I had no plan, but you did have a plan. And let's close that gap between no plan, meaning things happened sometimes because of serendipity or not foreseeable. There are things that happen that way. But there also is a general plan about, where you see the future and the role that you see Index playing in that future.
Yeah, I do. I guess, my version of the plan would be, we look at a lot of parallels to the financial markets because, like it or not, while ad tech and programmatic is kind of its own thing, we operate an ad exchange that is very comparable to the operations and fundamentals of the financial exchanges. And there is a little known protection that exists in the financial markets that I think matters a lot there. And I do really believe needs to continue to manifest in our business. It's something called national best bid price. And it's the premise that, if you have a share of a stock that you're attempting to buy or sell, regardless of the exchange that processes your order, in the moment in time before your order is filled, any broker has the opportunity to raise their hand and place that order. And what that guarantees is that your share of Apple is sold at the absolute highest price, or bought at the absolute lowest price in that moment. And you don't even have to think about it. You don't have to worry about it. It is just the way the market works. And I think that matters. And I think that creates a lot of trust. And that's what we try to do here at Index. You can kind of look at us as, it's easy to say, well, Google's enormous and they have all the engineers in the world. How could you ever compete with them? But the reality is, it's not about that. How, if there is no competition for a company like that, how can you ever know that they're driving publishers the best price? What would incentivize it? What would incentivize them to prioritize the publisher's margin over their own? There would be no incentive at all. Therefore, what we do does matter. And that is the company that I believe we are. And it doesn't mean that we're going to have 100% of the market share in this market. We don't need to be successful. It means that we're a check. And provided the market is sufficiently fair, I think that check lasts for a very long time. And I think it's very important to continuing to establish trust in this ecosystem. So that's really, to me, the plan. It's why the company's vision is something that we call total market efficiency. What we mean by that is every opportunity that we have the technical capacity to process at Index we want to. And today I would say outside of the walled gardens, the Googles and Facebooks or Pinterest or Snaps, we pretty much see the rest of the open internet, whether that's on the web, in app, or in streaming. And we have an opportunity to participate in every one of those transactions to the tune of 500 billion auctions every single day. Which bursts to millions per second. And that gives us a seat at the table next to a company like Google, 100% of the time, which I think is very valuable. And provided that seat is fair, I think we're providing a very important service. And so then if I think back to Andrew the Publisher 20 years ago, Andrew the Publisher 20 years ago, in the successful completion of this arc, shouldn't have to worry about whether or not their partners are giving them their fair share because there's a competitive market construct that guarantees it.
So well said, and what a this is why I enjoyed our conversation in London so much, Andrew. So talk about the arc of the business. What has been the thing that has surprised you the most, and is there something that has disappointed you the most?
Yeah, those are two good questions. I would say, surprised me the most would be, and this is just out of sheer ignorance, because I've really only ever been in one business my whole life. At each level of scale, everything gets a whole lot harder, and every problem that I perceived to be a problem before then looks trivial. And I think this is okay and healthy. But it's certainly been surprising as I have learned. And so, what I have also learned to do in response is to hire great leaders around me who bring incredible experience into the company that I certainly don't have public company experience, enterprise level experience, who can also bring best practices in that can solve the next problem faster without having to respond to it, because there's always a next problem and the challenge always gets harder at each level of scale. I think what surprised me the most is that it's not enough to have the best mousetrap or the best product or the best value proposition if you don't have you know, the trust of the market. If you don't have a well-established reputation, if you're not a known quantity. And so I think for a long time, as we were a smaller company, there were points where I was pretty frustrated because I believed that we were driving better value, that you know, competitors that I viewed as being larger than us were not achieving. However, through their position in the market or their reputation, they were able to effectively box us out. And I think what I gained an appreciation for is people do business with people, and you have to build trust, and you do that face to face. And so I think over the years, we got a whole lot better at meeting the market, at not just focusing on the weeds of the technology and the plumbing and the piping and trying to really be the best on the product, but also getting to know the market, getting close to the market, building real trust and relationships. And that's, I think, where we really hit our stride. And I think that's just, you know, again, maybe a surprise out of ignorance too, but something that at least as we were, certainly when we were a smaller company, was quite frustrating, you know, being in the corner, maybe lesser known, perceived to be a better product, but not getting the consideration that we thought we deserved, and doing something about it versus just, you know, being jaded or what have you.
Just terrific stuff, Andrew, again. And I think, you know, one of the reasons why we like Index Exchange so much is you really combine that notion of technology and humanity. And they're very different wells to draw water from. But I think you excel in both wells. Let's talk about politics as a prism and a metaphor for where we are now, where Index Exchange sits in that ecosystem. But you said something earlier when we were catching up about this is really the first purely programmatic election in many ways. Let's talk about that, what you see in your crystal ball. It's an interesting time, certainly, to say the least, for the United States of America.
It really is. Like we track, you know, every category's growth across the exchange continuously. And certainly, you know, political advertising has leveraged programmatic in prior cycles. But never to the degree that we're seeing right now. You know, where we sit today in September, we're pacing at 7x the category's growth from the last cycle, which was the primaries. And it's even more than the last election cycle 4 years ago, which is just not normal. We don't typically see cyclical growth of that magnitude. And the reason for it is we have, I think, enough trust and comfort built with political advertisers in and around DC from past cycles that they now kind of understand the technology, the value of programmatic, the ability to swap messaging in real time, the ability to highly target, especially zip codes and DMAs that are battlegrounds. And they also, I believe, have a lot of confidence that their media spend is going to real media from past cycles that they've really committed this time. But then what's additionally driven it has been the explosion in streaming. Even 4 years ago for the last political cycle, streaming was big, but 4 years later, streaming is everything. The growth that we've seen in the business has been has just blown away any prior channel's growth. We've never seen anything like streaming. It grows every single day, and not just ad spend. I'm specifically referring to the consumer's consumption. More and more TV is being watched through CTV, either through smart TV apps, fast apps, or the direct content owners applications every single day, which is pretty exciting. And you couple that with programmatic, which gives you the ability to assume all of that scale, target effectively, and do so in a way that is super efficient to plan and buy. And you just have a bit of a powder keg. So you have all that going on. But then what you additionally have is lessons from past cycles. So even the primaries 2 years ago or the other cycles that we've seen before, a significant number of publishers would block political advertising because of concerns about policy, concerns about transparency requirements. And a lot of those concerns we have been working on in the background really since the primaries. And so we are in a world of a different place.
Internally at Index, we have members of our exchange quality team that are trained on the policies of most of our larger publishers so that we know ahead of time when we're seeing a new creative or bid what is acceptable and what is not. Additionally, we are well aware of the transparency requirements the publishers have so that they can report ad spend on the origin of ad spend so that they can be in compliance with their own requirements. These are all lessons learned from past cycles that are now embedded into the workflow. And I think it's kind of just a perfect storm of all of that and, yet another incredibly competitive election, which I suppose isn't terribly surprising, but it's just the reality of the current state. The only additional thing that I would say that I think is quite relevant specifically to programmatic would be the auction itself. If you think of battleground states and DMAs and zip codes that are highly competitive, it's actually very conducive to an auction. And so, what we're seeing and hearing, especially as we approach, a few weeks out and a few days before the election, some zip codes and some DMAs might see triple digit, high triple digit to four digit CPMs, which is just hard to wrap your mind around. But like imagine a, a $999 CPM. We're probably going to see that in a few zip codes. You can't really do that in anything other than a market-based construct like programmatic. So I think it's very well tailored to this specific type of advertising.
So clearly, this is good for business. Talk about your commitment and part of the DNA. You talked about efficiency, about index exchange, but transparency is another very big part of your DNA. Talk about that juxtaposed against an election that crazily, has been thrown into question by one of the candidates who, unless he wins, doesn't think it's fair.
Yes. So transparency is everything to Index. And a lot of it comes back to the lessons from the past cycles, where, I'll say a couple of things that are very important and also lead to us turning down money, but I think it's appropriate. We will not allow a new campaign to run across the exchange without human review. Full stop. So, if somebody is trying to game the system or swap out problematic messaging on the fly, we won't allow that spend to happen. We need human eyes on every creative. And then a series of checks follow that. Again, as provided to us by our incredible publishers, we think of us as maintaining a superset of all of their policies. Then additionally, we need to know the origin of any dollar spent so that that can be transparently reported back. And then that also all turns into controls for every publisher. And so there are certainly, there's a spectrum of publishers. There are also still publishers today that run no political ads. There are publishers that run all political ads, and then there are publishers that run, maybe only issue-based ads, for instance. And so those all become controls that we afford to every publisher so that they run their businesses however they see fit or however their policy teams require them to. And so our commitment to them is, they're in full control of their business. Everything is transparent and everything has been vetted with human eyes. Which we think is the most and the best that we can do in our role as being effectively a transactional exchange. Beyond that, it's up to each individual publisher to run their business how they see fit.
Such a interesting conversation, such a timely conversation. So, Andrew, as we start to wrap, the picture ahead is bright. You're 600 strong globally. Give me a sense, if we're having this conversation again in London, as we likely will, what do you think we'll touch on in the spring of 25 or even a year from now that we didn't touch on today?
Well, I am very curious to see what happens with this trial. So that may very well be part of the discussion in this coming spring for sure. Not to overly belabor Google, but also We really need more clarity on the cookie deprecation delay. You know, they have pivoted to user choice, but they haven't provided the exact messaging or design that they'll be going with for that pivot, which I think does still carry potentially an equal implication to the original concern that was cookie deprecation. So I think that'll be very, very relevant. Streaming is continuing to explode. That's not going to change. If anything, we've seen more inventory on board this year than any year prior, especially as you've seen the Netflixes of the world and the Amazons of the world get into the game. There is a bit of a supply and demand change that is requiring pricing strategies to evolve. A lot more supply has hit the market, which is putting pressure on pricing, which is compelling, you know, more and more creative yield optimization in that particular category. Otherwise, you know, the hope is we are on a positive macro footing. You know, we've had some uncertainty over the last few years, at least, you know, as this year has played out so far, it's been pretty positive. There's a lot of optimism about the back half too. You know, every year is a new chapter. So, you know, we may or may not be touching on that again this coming spring.
Well, I love ending on a positive note. I love our evolving relationship, Andrew. You're a great, great guest, whether it's on the stage or on the air here on Great Minds. And I can't thank you enough, as well as your team, for following up on what we discussed in London, which is doing exactly what we just did.
Well, thank you so much. I really enjoyed our time in London and on the pod as well. Thank you again.
All right. We'll see you soon, pal.